So we're joined now by Irwin Cohen, who was in the front office with the Detroit Tigers for the retirement ceremony of Hank Greenberg in 1983. Irwin, thanks for joining us. And tell us a bit about your background in baseball and with the Tigers.
Okay, thank you very much. I started following baseball in 1950. I was 9 years old at the time, so obviously I missed Hank Greenberg playing. But growing up in a Jewish home, that's all I heard about, really. My mother never followed baseball at all, but she told me in 1935 she went to a ball game because her girlfriends wanted to see Hank Greenberg. So this is when Old Navin Field, they just had two decks from first base to third base, and it was no lights, obviously. So they took a streetcar, and of course, my father followed baseball, and that's how I got into it, because I was listening to Tigers announcer Harry Heilman in 1948-1949, but nothing gelled with me until 1950 when I started listening to him anytime and really following the team. And those days, we didn't have a TV, so the name Hoot Evers rang a bell with me. He was a left fielder with the Tigers, and he became my favorite player because I was watching old cowboy movies when we did have a TV later in the year, and there was a fellow named Hoot Gibson. So it turns out that's why Walter Evers was known as Hoot Evers, because he always was a big fan of Hoot Gibson. So in those days, when you can hear in the background and go to a game, the fans would sort of cheer, Hoot, Hoot, it was a cheer. So it was like H-O-O-O-O-T, you know, like an owl. And so Evers played left field. My first game, I went in 1950, June, and there was an afternoon game between the White Sox and Tigers, and Evers was in left field, and I sat a couple of rows behind him, and he had an inside-the-park home run. I'll never forget it. And I was off the fence in front of me. And when he pulled up to second base, we sort of, in my 9-year-old mind, made eye contact as he was looking through the screen as he was rounding second. And he became my favorite. And then let's fast forward to 1973. Hank Aaron, of course, was becoming the new home run, all-time home runs. But there was a show in Detroit on radio at 8 o'clock every Monday night, 8 till 9. And the host, Vince Doyle, would never mention that Aaron has already been up almost like 2 years more than Babe Ruth in terms of at-bats. So I wanted to call, but I was pretty shy in those days, shyer than now. And I put it off 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Finally, 3 weeks went by, and I called him. It was only on Monday nights. And about 20 to 9, the show was from 8 to 9, and the producer said, sorry, you have too many, you can't get on. So I said, I'll tell you what, I really don't have to be on the air. I just wanted to tell the host something. So after the show, he got on, and I pointed out the fact that he never mentioned that Hank Aaron's been up so many more times at bats than Babe Ruth. So he said, he will mention. And thank you. And since we were off the air, I said, by the way, and this, by the way, changed my life forever and the reason why I'm talking to you right now. So I said, by the way, who's your guest next week? Because there was a guest each Monday night from the sports world. And he said, our guest next week is Hoot Evers. As you may know, he's the director of the minor league system for the Tigers, and most people don't remember that he was an outfielder for the Tigers. I said, of course I remember. Number 14 is my favorite player of all time. I still have his baseball card. So he said, I'll tell you what, that's amazing. Why don't you come down and introduce him on the air? It's nice to have a fan's touch. So I did come down. I wrote something. The first thing I ever wrote that wasn't a letter or something forced from a school report. And I decided, I read it on the air, and I enjoyed it. That could have been the end of my career. And he gave me a booklet, the host did, and I asked Hoot Evers, can I drive him to the ballpark where his car was? This was about a mile and a half from the radio station. And we did. And we talked about Roberto Clemente, who just died in the plane crash. And that was it. And I thought that could have been the end of everything. But I read this little all sports TV guide that I got from the host, and it was sort of operated by Denny McLean and Dick Raddatz at the time. It was giving away free to bowling alleys and free to restaurants and anywhere else. So they were looking for writers. So I called up Denny McLean. They had the phone number in there, and this was 1973, a couple of years after he retired. And so I said, I'm a writer. I happened to write the introduction for Hoot Eaters on the WWJ call-in show. Denny McLean said, oh, he heard that. So he says, come down. And I started writing for the very first time. And the Tigers were a last place team around that time. They were looking for any kind of publicity. And I started covering the Tigers on a sort of a Sunday basis, getting out to the field, doing some interviews. And that was a kickoff. And after a while, I met some other people. And I said, let's launch. This is days before ESPN. Let's launch a baseball monthly publication. Most people dropped out. And I saw through and I founded the Baseball Bulletin, which lasted for 5 years on a monthly basis and went national. And luckily, I sold it for almost the amount of debts 5 years later. But I got to meet all kinds of people, officials and ball players, and Pete Rose, Steve Garvey did 200 interviews. I met probably all, even Babe Ruth's roommate at the time, Jimmy Reese and a few others. And it was a lot of fun. And the Tigers knew me, of course. And by 1983, there was an opening in the front office that I took. And before that, I was working for the local Detroit area government. One thing led to another. They said the title is Director of Group Ticket Sales, but it gave me a lot of other things to do. I wrote things for the scoreboard, like Where Are They Now? You know, so all the Tigers from the 50s, 60s, 70s, we featured a different one on the scoreboard each day, and I did that. I worked with the players. And of course, there's many duties besides the title that I had. So I still do some writing here and there. And you can Google me, and there, you know, there's a lot of places that I do write for here and there. And we can take it from there. Now, as far as Greenberg, of course, in June 83, I met him. And I thought he was the most charismatic man I ever met in baseball. I would say Steve Garvey would, but Greenberg was had more stories, obviously. And I was lucky enough to be part of a pool that day that there were some writers that before the ceremonies, it was a doubleheader with the Cleveland Indians, and the retirement ceremony was between games. So between games, I was on the field, and I took pictures. And I have a Shutterfly book that I made, pictures with Hank and his son Steve, and standing next to Vic Wirtz. I probably took about 25 pictures that I sent to Steve. And this was back then in 83, and got a nice letter from him. And we were part of the pool, of a writer's pool, that we asked a lot of questions. And one question I did ask Hank, the other writers never got to that one. And I thought it was very interesting because in the Jewish community, there was a rumor that the pitchers didn't want a Jew to break Babe Ruth's record, or the players didn't want it, or the umpires didn't want it. So that was a strong rumor in the Jewish community. And I always hear that when I speak to different groups. And I asked Hank that, and he says, absolutely not. He says most people wanted him to break it, most of the players, and the umpires was his friend. And then he said when he hit his 57th home run, he said it was against Cleveland. He was thrown out at home plate by a mile. It was really a triple that he tried to stretch into a home run. And he said the catcher was a friend of his and the umpire was a friend of his. However, if you read the book, you know, on Hank Greenberg, it's a little bit different. So his memory is a little bit different than that. But that's how Hank remembered it, that people wanted him to break the record. Of course, he wanted it too. So there was no prejudice involved. He just ran out of gas and he ran into Bowfeller too often.
Let me ask you a little bit about the background of the ceremony itself. So the Tigers, if I have it right, hadn't retired a number or had such a ceremony until Al Kaline in 1980. How did it come about in the front office that in 1983, the team decided to honor Charlie Gehringer and Hank Greenberg?
It was sort of a 50-year anniversary, you know, from the great years. Greenberg's first year was 1933. And he really wasn't a big star until the following year, 1934. But I think it just came about. They were looking for ways to get more fans in. They were becoming more marketing conscious. And when I joined the Tigers, I tried for years to get something like Michigan Avenue was one side of Tiger Stadium. It was the first base side. And I said, why don't we turn it into sort of a Hollywood Boulevard with stars? And like Grauman's Chinese Theater, they had famous movie stars put their handprints and footprints. So I said, look, they have all these people like Hank Greenberg, Charlie Gehringer, Hal Neuhauser. You can even say people who played in All-Star Games in Detroit, Mickey Mantle, Joe DiMaggio was still alive. That's all gone. So once I got in there, you know, they would look the other way, like I'm a little bit nuts, you know, why do we need that kind of thing. And when Bo Schembechler took over, he didn't want to hear it either. He became president of the Tigers for about a year or so. And he said, trouble with you, Cohen, your ideas cost money. And so they were very money conscious at that time, as they always were. The Tigers were known for that. But they really, I also wanted to do something with a coloring book for kids. You know, they have pictures of Greenberg, Kaline, all the great Tiger stars, of drawings, of ballpark. You give away crayons to young kids, and let them become baseball fans that way. It's very cheap. You know, we had a bat day for years. You had bobblehead day, so why not a coloring book crayon day? Nope, they didn't want to hear stuff like that. Finally, they got my idea of Paws, P-A-W-S, the mascot. So that was my idea that we tried for years. It wasn't successful when I was there, but after I left and the Ilitch administration came in, they did that. So that was, Paws was one of the names I hit on. I even had drawings for the mascot, but it didn't come about till after I left. I worked under the Monahan administration. Tom Monahan was a great, great owner, much better than Ilitch, according to the people who were there. And when I was there, the difference was, is that when Monahan made us feel like we were owners too, of course, he didn't butt in anything. So we couldn't go to him and say, let's do this, let's do that. But he gave us an attendance clause and we got so much money every time the attendance reached something. We became stockholders. We had meetings. So it was all attendance clause. We felt we were part of something.
Take us back to that day in 1983 in June. You talked about your interactions with Hank and I presume Charlie as well on the field. Can you describe their mood? I would assume it was some combination of nerves and excitement. What was it like as they were waiting to take the field for that event?
Hank was very, very happy, and he was a good friend of Charlie, and they were opposites in personalities. Charlie was reserved. Hank always had the smile on his face that day. I'm looking at the pictures now that I took in this book I made, and there's one with Steve. He's smiling. He's wearing a light blue suit, black tie, and a checkered pink and bluish shirt. Mostly blue. And here's one picture I'm looking at him with Vic Wertz. And he's the only one that always is smiling. And it was sort of about at around second base. And Kaline spoke, Ernie Harwell spoke. I see Bill Freehan in the background, George Kell. And for the pictures, I promised to send them to Steve, which I did. And Hank gave me a personalized autograph, which I blew up, and it's sort of on the front cover of the book. It says, "To Irwin, best wishes, Hank Greenberg." So, of course, that meant a lot to me. We had about 33,000 in attendance, if I remember. And I took a picture of him holding uniform number 5. And there were several of his old teammates, like Bertie Tebbets and Barney McCoskey, people like that. But George Kell had a great time, it seemed. And there was new ones like Bill Freehan, of course, who never played with him. So he seemed to be a little out of place to me anyway, you know, sitting in the background.
Recently rewatching The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg, and this scene is shown, and my recollection is that Hank said, you know, a lot of the people who were in attendance and who stood and greeted me when I was introduced probably had never seen me play. Surely some were in attendance who did see him in the 30s and 40s, but perhaps the majority had not. Tell us about that reaction that the crowd gave him, and did it surprise you how warmly he was embraced, given how far removed his playing days were?
Yes, you're right. Most people didn't see him. I was 42 years old at the time, in 1983. I've never seen him play. And so, of course, you would have to be, I would guess, 47, 48 to even remember him at that time and up. So he was right. Most people didn't see him play. But he was so charismatic, and it just, you had to like this guy right away as soon as he opened his mouth. So I think that's how he won over the crowd. And then when they put his record up, somebody who hits 58 home runs and knocks in so many runs, who can do those RBIs in a 154-game season? You couldn't even, most people won't even do it in a 200-game season today. And so that's, it was just charismatic, smiling, and he seemed to tower over everybody. He was 6'3 and a half. And I mean, especially with George Kell next to him and Ernie Harwell. But it was amazing time. And it was happened to be a beautiful day weather-wise. And if I recall, I could be wrong, the Tigers won both games, but we weren't watching the games. We were really watching him. And that was the main part of the day for me, especially. I probably took about at least 50, 60 pictures that day.
Did the crowd's reaction surprise you at all? I mean, even though you hadn't seen Greenberg play, you described what he meant to you as a young fan. But you didn't know, you know, how many of the fans in the stands knew his story, knew his significance. So what was your reaction to the crowd's embrace of Hank and Charlie when they were introduced?
Well, I think it was not only a cheer for Hank, it was for everybody, because they did have former Tiger heroes like George Kell, of course, as I mentioned, on the field sitting behind him. And then there was even some older players that older fans would remember. But it was from my time, from the 1950s, it was Kell and Wirtz, you know, that meant a lot to me growing up years. And, you know, seeing Hank and knowing his accomplishments when they put his record and talked about his home runs, and people cheered. I think a lot of people were there not even knowing much about him, just hearing maybe a real fan would knew his name and knowing 58, but some of them didn't even know about the RBI totals. But he won everybody over that once he started talking, as he did with the writers. You know, everybody sort of fell in love with him. We were doing it in underground behind home plate in a room. It's a room for the certain employees and high Tiger officials, and scouts come in after the game. And so we were doing it in that room, a dark mahogany panel, and it was Greenberg and Gehringer and maybe only about 6 writers and myself and a few Tigers officials. So it was a very memorable almost an hour before the first game, and of course the ceremony itself between games.
You mentioned Vic Wirtz, and I vaguely recall in one of the photos he's sitting, I don't know if it's next to Greenberg or in that main row with Greenberg and Gehringer and Kaline and Kell. I hadn't realized that he had such a prominent position in that ceremony. Now, I guess he was, he lived in the area. He was a businessman in the area, I guess, in his retirement. And I would speculate he had a relationship with Hank. I don't know if they were teammates, but he played for Cleveland when Hank was GM. Can you tell us more about that connection and and how Vic came to be seated there that day?
Okay, Vic, we're looking for players who played with him. I assume that Greenberg, of course, we all know his last year with the Tigers is 1946. So that might have been Wirtz's rookie year. So Wirtz was in the Army, but he, like Evers, Evers was there in 46. And Greenberg was the type of guy that he took the rookies out to eat and the young players out to eat. And he was very welcoming to them. That's something I've heard. So they were sort of endeared to him. So I have a feeling that, that Wirtz did play a year or two when he was very young with Greenberg. And he became teammates. But Wirtz was always around the ballpark, and he was a beer distributor. Very nice man. And of course, he's easy to recognize because he was bald as a player. And I remember when he would come out of lockers, you knew who he was. He was the only one wearing a hat, a dress hat. And very nice man, very charismatic. So, of course, Cal played with Greenberg, too, for a bit. For maybe a year or two. So that's why they were there. But as I mentioned before, the freehand connection, I've never figured out why he was back there and sitting down. You know, he was the only one that I recall that didn't, was never a teammate in, or didn't play in the same era.
Right. Although, of course, Kaline didn't either. They were just sort of Detroit royalty from the 60s, right?
Right, big names in Detroit. Now, as far as Wirtz being a, when Greenberg was GM, you know, Wirtz was a member of the Indians in 54, obviously. When you speak about Greenberg as a GM, the players didn't revere him as a GM. In fact, they didn't like him at all because he was very, very tough. As most GMs, you know, are, that you have to, you know, save money for the team, and Greenberg owned a piece of the team. But I went through a lot of newspapers and in the 50s, and I would love going through there. And, of course, Greenberg wasn't in Detroit. He was in Cleveland. But he would always sort of knock his players for not trying hard enough, not really trying, not practicing as much as he did. And he was out there all the time when he was a player, and he would say the players don't practice enough, don't feel it's important to work out enough, you know, because he was the type of person who would pay kids to come out and shag fly balls for him. And one was a weatherman in Detroit, Sonny Elliott, real name Marvin Schlossberg as a kid. He wasn't impressed with Greenberg's hitting prowess because he said he wasn't hitting him far. And then he realized that the balls were wet. And then after a certain time of batting practice, he would switch to the balls that weren't quite as wet, and they still didn't go out. And then after a certain amount of more time, then he would switch to regular dry baseballs, and those would go into the stands. And so Greenberg was that kind of fellow that he always practiced and practiced to make himself better and better. And he felt a lot of the players, even members of his own team, did not do that, did not take it their job seriously enough. And of course, he was a tough negotiator too. So if you were an owner, you would like him as a GM. But if you were a player, I don't think you would.
One last note on Wirtz. We would be remiss if we didn't know that Vic Wirtz hit the ball that Willie Mays caught. He made the catch in the Polo Grounds in the World Series. Few players could be as proud of a flyout as Wirtz could about that ball. But at the risk of reducing his career to that, I just feel you have to mention that when we mention his name.
I saw that on TV, and that was a game I believe Dusty Rhodes hit two home runs, and the Polo Grounds right field had an overhang. It wasn't much more than 250 feet to hit a home run. You can pop up a ball in right field. So here they said that both of Dusty Rhodes' home runs wouldn't have traveled as far as McCourt Suzuki.
You mentioned the relationship with Greenberg as GM, and part of it was the work ethic, and part of it was there's the famous story with, was it Al Rosen, where Greenberg said, look, here's what I hit when I was your age, and you didn't hit that well. I don't know if Rosen was in attendance in 83, but what can you tell us about that relationship?
Okay, Rosen was not in attendance in 83, and it was, of course, 1953, Rosen almost won the Triple Crown. You know, he just missed the batting championship to Mickey Vernon by a fraction of a point. And Mickey Vernon was at bat, coming to at bat in the on-deck circle. Eddie Yost was on first. And Eddie Yost tried to steal second, everybody says on purpose, to be thrown out to give Mickey Vernon the championship. And there was a famous play that Rosen was like a bang-bang play at first base, but Rosen Bitsy was out at first, and he lost by a fraction of a point the batting championship. Of course, he won the home runs and RBIs. He just missed the Triple Crown. So 1954, Rosen had a pretty good year, but he was injured. He had 300 with 24 homers. And then in 1955, he slipped. And in 1956, his last year with Cleveland, he batted 267 with 15 home runs. But they moved him from third to first, and Rosen felt that, you know, he volunteered to move also. Whatever the team asked for him to do, he did. And he had broken thumbs. He missed a lot of games. And he was injured. And Greenberg kept cutting him. And Greenberg made a deal, as far as I know, and Rosen knows, to trade him to Boston. And Rosen refused to go. Also, Al Lopez, who is the manager of the Indians, was now going to the White Sox. And he wanted Rosen. And Greenberg refused to trade him over there. So Rosen retired, and he said he had many more ties to Cleveland than Greenberg did, more in the Jewish community, because Rosen was a much more observant person than he would not play on Jewish holidays and die holidays. Well, Greenberg would have. In 1935, people don't realize that he said he was going to play on Yom Kippur, but he was injured and he did not play. It's sort of like the old TV show Maud. Remember that? She used to always say, God will get you for that, you know. So I think he had a broken wrist and he missed a couple of games. So, but Rosen's wife told me that she felt that Greenberg didn't want another Jewish big star, even though he wasn't in Cleveland while he was there. I don't believe that, but she believed that. Rosen himself, I don't think would believe that, but that was Mrs. Rosen's view of it. But the point was that Hank thought he was doing Al a favor by trading him to Boston with the short porch in Fenway. So what? Depends how you look at it.
You mentioned your awareness of Greenberg as a young fan, a young Jewish fan, and the sense of the significance he had. Greenberg is one, I guess, because of the how long ago he played and the fact that it was before the era of television, where he's not on the top tier of baseball stars that we usually think about when we think of Ruth and Mantle and DiMaggio and Williams. Can you summarize for us the significance of Greenberg as a player and as a pioneer, and why and how we should remember him today?
I think he wasn't remembered as DiMaggio. Obviously, he was more lumbering. He didn't have a graceful gait in the way he would run around the bases. But one thing surprised me, that Greenberg, I think he played less games than DiMaggio. You have to look that one up. But he had more stolen bases than DiMaggio in his career. And also, he hit more home runs, more frequent than DiMaggio did, more times at bat, less times at bat than DiMaggio would to hit a home run. And so his All-time average was lower than DiMaggio's, but his home runs were greater. His RBI per seasons, you know, were greater. But DiMaggio played in New York, had that gracefulness about him, you know, when he was going in the outfield. But Greenberg was better than I think people think he was. He was a great player. They just didn't have that, you know, Ted Williams swagger to him. Like Ted Williams is the real John Wayne. Ted Williams, you know, can hit the home runs every year. But Greenberg was better, and he should have been. Of course, he was in Lou Gehrig's shadow for years as a first baseman. And so he wasn't the all-star every year. But if you look at him, you look at his, it's only 1 year that he didn't really hit 300, and that was in 1946. And to be gone 5 years, how many players are missing 5 years? And the thing is, if you look at DiMaggio's war record, he played ball. He only missed about 2 years or something like that. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't say for sure. But Greenberg missed almost five seasons.
Yeah, one of the great what-ifs. What would those numbers have been? On the other hand, his military service distinguished him as more than a baseball hero, but an American hero.
Yeah, but he was in the military twice. He got out because they said men of a certain age will be released. So he was released before Pearl Harbor. Then after Pearl Harbor, he goes back in. And he becomes a gunner. And he did see action. And so this is why he was a big hero to people.
Yeah, so his military service and the fact that before that he overcame such anti-Semitism to become the first a Jewish superstar, that really makes him more than just a baseball hero. It makes him a hero on sort of a cultural level. Is that fair to say? How would you describe him as his significance as more than just a baseball star?
That was definitely because of the era he played in, the Nazi era. So if you're looking at the paper, they didn't cover the Holocaust as much as they should have in many newspapers. Of course, many say they didn't know what was going on in Europe so much, but the tremendous anti-Semitism in Germany, that the Jews couldn't, they were stripped of citizenship. They couldn't even have bank accounts. They couldn't hold jobs and their businesses, and they couldn't leave the country. So it was like they were prisoners. The only thing they can be is beaten and robbed, and the police couldn't come and save them. They didn't want to. So here, you're reading all this, you're knowing all this, or certainly the Jews knew this, that what was going on in Europe, and here comes Hank Greenberg, bigger than anybody else. He was bigger than DiMaggio, bigger than Williams, you know, in size, you know, and he was as good as any of the other players. There's a famous picture of him in the All-Star game in Griffith Stadium. He was the biggest guy in the group, with Joe Cronin and DiMaggio, people like that, Bill Dickey. So it was just something to look up to, you know. And of course, he didn't change his name. He could have been Hank Green, and nobody would know if he wanted to hide it. But he was proud of it, and that was it. And so this is why he endeared himself to the Jewish community. If you talk to anybody that grew up in those days, people like the actor Walter Matthau, they just said, this was great. They lived and died with what he did in the box scores. So he really meant something to people.
Anything else you want to share with us about the retirement ceremony in 83? Or your connection with Greenberg?
That he was very, very charismatic to fans and the writers. And you know, you just had to like him. I would think that the only people who wouldn't like him, but they had to respect him, were the players who had to deal with him as he was general manager, because he thought the players should do at least what he did, put in as much time, you know, prior to games or on off days, practicing and hiring kids to pitch to him and that kind of thing to make himself greater. You know, he took what he had and he made it, I think, to a higher level, to the best level that he could. and the kind of man he was, and you know, was charismatic, a good dresser. He was kind of a person that everybody wanted as a big brother, as a son, as a you know, the girls wanted him as a husband, that kind of thing. So he you know, was like a movie star. It was like maybe a Gregory Peck to, you know, to those who followed sports, or certainly a John Wayne. It was all that rolled into one, a Clark Gable, you know, at least, you know, to the Jewish youth.
Great. Well, so many memories and such an important legacy. Irwin Cohen, thanks for sharing these memories and telling these stories.
Well, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.